On this week's episode of the We Don't Know Either podcast, we're joined by a very special guest, Dr. Susan Pell from the United States Botanic Garden.
By the end of the episode, you'll be bursting with knowledge like an explosive cucumber.
What is an explosive cucumber?
Google it.
Okay, we're going to Google it. But first, enjoy the show.
Enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome into episode number 364 of the We Don't Know Either podcast. I'm Lindsay.
I'm Nick.
I'm Susan Pell.
And she's the Susan Pell.
Yeah.
We are so excited to have you here on the show. So Dr. Susan Pell is the Deputy Executive Director at the United States Botanic Garden. Very cool stuff. Give everybody that's listening a little quick insight into your day-to-day.
Wow. So I help run the garden, and we are the oldest continuously operating garden in the United States, public garden, that is.
That's not your fact today?
That's not my fact.
I was like, I could have gotten that one right.
Yeah.
No, definitely. There's a lot of facts about the Botanic Garden that I can sort of micro quiz you on maybe, but no, that's not my big fact. So we serve over a million visitors a year, and we just tell them about how cool plants are and how important they are for our daily lives and for the environment.
Yeah, see, I always think that we do really well with the number of people in attendance, but then you just start throwing around numbers like a million, and we're like, oh, okay, we still have a ways to go.
Well, there is a specific reason that you're here. It was a perfect mashup because we're going to be hosting trivia at the Botanic Garden at the end of February.
Right, so that micro quiz she was teasing earlier is going to become a macro quiz here soon.
Yeah, what can folks expect when they come to this event at the Garden on Thursday? Well, Thursday the 27th of February.
So, yeah, you can expect to have some amazing trivia questions thrown at you, lots of plant nerd facts and some fun just sort of plants and culture facts as well, and definitely have a wonderful evening at the garden inside the conservatory. The whole conservatory will be open, surrounded by plants. There's no better way to do trivia, I think.
Yeah, and this is closed. It's just for the folks playing trivia. So this is about as, I would say, like intimate, you know.
Behind the scenes, yeah. After hours, backstage-y, yeah.
Night at the museum.
Exactly.
Except everyone at this museum now it's not a museum, but like actually living because it's all plants.
Right.
Yeah, and we actually are a museum too. So we're an accredited museum and an accredited botanic garden.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that it was both accreditation.
Yeah,
I'm learning already.
Yeah, how do you get accredited for things like that?
So American Alliance of Museums, AAM, has a whole process. You've got to have a collection that you sort of manage in a database,
sure.
And all kinds of other policies in place. We actually have a library. We have a living collection. We have a collections policy that dictates what plants come into our collection.
Sure.
Yeah, so is all those things, emergency plans, all that.
Is there like square footage requirements and
there's
like
no
buildings?
Square footage requirements.
No.
You can be a tiny little micro
really?
Museum, and yeah,
because
there's
we have some really cool trivia questions.
Nick's trying collection.
Nick's trying to get us to be a museum. That's not happening. But the other really exciting thing about this program, in addition that your tickets come with food and drinks, people, you know, read between the lines. There, it's going to be awesome. But this is the first time in the history of the company that we have a new bonus round.
Yeah, that was it's been 10 years with our picture puzzle, fill in the blank, and music rounds. But when we started working with the Botanic Garden, we started going through and a number of our staff members got a really great tour. They actually haven't stopped talking about it. I wish they would talk about it a little less, especially in public, because we keep talking about all of the really cool things and all the really great ideas that we had. And with some of the options that are going to be available to these players out there, we decided our regular bonus rounds weren't good enough. We had to do something cooler. So
we have an identify round. So
yeah.
Susan and her team actually pulled some specimens. We don't want to give too much away, but you're going to actually be physically touching them, figuring some more things out. So it's kind of the most interactive thing that we've done.
Yeah.
We're super excited about it. And of course, we like change. We like new things. We like to be innovative at the garden. And so we're super psyched to have this new round.
Yeah, we are too. And now we're going to be everybody who comes to this is going to be super excited about it. And then we're going to have to figure out a way to get it in the regular trivia.
Yeah, so Susan, as I've been researching you, and obviously I took your tour at the Botanic Garden, I was going to say my tour guide was very cool, and she's like sitting right here. And you've talked a lot about the coolness of plants. And so what do you really want people to know, like why plants are cool?
Yeah, so we basically want our visitors to appreciate plants. And if that means, you know, they learn information about kind of the plants that they're surrounded by every day, so the plants we're wearing on our bodies, like clothing, the plants that we're living inside of and our housing, or the plants that we're eating every day, or the plants that the animals that we're eating are eating. So, like, mm-hmm. lots of levels, right, of how the plants are part of our everyday lives. That's right. A really big part of our mission. But we also want people to understand the importance of plants to the environment and to conservation, and so the role that plants have in sustaining kind of all life, not just human life.
Cool. Like, that's, I don't have anything else to, like, beside just cool. Like, everything that you think about has a plant tie-in, obviously. So in your opinion, what's the most important plant? Like, you had to have a draft, or if you had to pick the most important plant.
Lindsay, just to give you a little bit of backstory, Lindsay is huge on the idea of running drafts and ranking things.
Oh, yeah.
Or just like the Mount Rushmore of plants. What to you is the most important one?
So I'm going to be really obnoxious, and I'm not going to pick a single plant. I'm going to pick a plant family.
Oh,
okay. And I'm actually going to pick like three plant families. Bear with me.
Well, she asked for the Mount Rushmore, so we need a fourth in there.
All right. Perfect. So the grass family is actually really, really important. And I mean the Poaceae, the lawn grasses, but not the lawn grasses. They're not the most important. It's the things that we eat. It's the grains. Yeah. So rice and wheat, the things that sustain, you know, tons of millions and billions of people around the world. The bean family is also a really important family because the beans are so, you know, rich in protein and whatnot. So, those two families, I would say, are probably the two most important families to human health. And they're really important. I mean, they're just very large families also, and they're
right.
present in a lot of different habitats and that kind of thing, too. So those two families of plants, I would say, are probably the most important. One of my favorite families is the Rosaceae family, the rose family, which has roses, which are lovely, but also has things like peaches and cherries and apricots, apples and pears, and a lot of really delicious fruits that we like to eat. So that's sort of just a really nice family to have around because lots of good edibles in there. And then I am actually an expert in the poison ivy family. So that is my favorite family, the Anacardiaceae.
Also your favorite Batman villain, or
kind of, yeah. Yeah, pretty much all things poison ivy. Yeah, exactly right.
I'm looking at your list. You got grasses, they feed the entire population of the United States. You've got beans, which also do the same thing. You've got the rose family with all the fruits and everything
Delicious.
That also sustain it, and then poison ivy.
This
is definitely a Sesame Street moment where one of these things doesn't belong.
Except that the poison ivy family also has mangoes, pistachios, and cashews. So
you are
delicious
kidding.
And poisonous. Kind of a little bit of both worlds.
Pistachios aren't nuts?
Pistachios, so botanically they're not nuts, but they are a seed. And most of the things that we call nuts are seeds.
Okay.
And some of them are seeds of true botanical nuts, and some of them are seeds of other types of fruits like drupes, things like cherries or peaches. So peach pits, different cultivar, different species, but essentially the seed that's inside of a peach is really similar to an almond.
Okay.
But so an almond's not technically botanically a nut, but it's a seed and we call it a nut.
So you've got peanuts, which aren't
not a nut,
and then you've got almonds, which are not a nut. And then you've got, what is a nut?
So coconut's not a nut.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
It's walnuts?
Walnuts, not a nut.
Wait, not a nut,
why don't we just have Susan tell us what is a nut? What is a nut?
So acorns are nuts, just to be confusing. Yeah. The vast majority of the things that we eat as nuts are not really nuts. They're seeds of other types of fruits. Most of them are drupes. And a drupe is basically a fruit that has a skin, a flesh, and a hard pit in the middle. And it's the seed from that hard pit that we eat as a nut. So those are things like almonds, walnuts, pecans. Those are all the seeds of drupes.
Okay, well, Susan, you actually presented a perfect segue into my interesting fact, a little bit in your wheelhouse, and maybe not a little bit in your wheelhouse. We shall see. Okay, so as a scientist, how do you learn, right? So you say, okay, I want to learn more about X plant or X species. What's the first step that you take? You're physically examining something, right?
Yeah, typically. I mean, it kind of depends on what sort of science you're doing. But yeah, usually I'm looking at a thing. As a botanist, I'm usually looking at a plant.
Okay, well, back in the olden days, it was kind of hard to get live plants places, right? Because shipping and things took a very long time. So I don't know if you're familiar with the glass flower exhibit at Harvard.
I am.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe she knows my fact here. Okay, so this was end of the 19th century. Harvard commissioned these beautiful, atomically correct so that people could study them, right?
From a father and son who made them. They're amazing.
Oh, okay. German she knows so artists. Much.
Right. I was going to say, this is one of those ones where you're going to ask the question, and I'm just going to go, nope, I'm not going to answer it.
Yes. So father and son, they worked on these for 40 years, for the majority of their life. They had a partnership that was only supposed to last 10 years, but they kept making more and more and more of them. They ended up having 4,300 models, over 780 plant species. And from my understanding, a lot of botanists and scientists said that they are so anatomically correct, you really, there's not anything wrong. And they've tried to find things that were wrong with them.
I found one error when I went to the collection.
Whoa, what was it?
It was really, really specific. So it was in a, it was either, I think it was an avocado specimen. So flowers, fruits, everything. And the anthers, which are the part of the flower that have the pollen in it, they dehisce, they open up in a certain way. And this is true for all flowers. They have anthers that open up in a certain way. And in that family, the Lauraceae, the avocado family, they have these like flaps that come up. And I believe, as I recall, that the orientation of the flaps was not correct. But this was a while ago. Maybe they've fixed it. I don't know. Or maybe, you know, the orientation was just flipped or something. But yeah, the orientation of the dehiscence of the flaps of the anthers was, so I believe,
when you were
incorrect
going, when
in
you were
a Lauraceae specimen.
When you were going through that, were you trying to find stuff? Were you like, I want to see if these glass blowers actually were accurate?
No, I was not like being the obnoxious museum visitor. We're like, where's the error? I was just like, oh, these are so amazing. I can't believe how phenomenal this collection is. And then I happened to see the error.
Oh, okay. Well, that I think is very fair, because I feel like sometimes we get that with trivia players where they're like, we're going to find the error. And we're like, oh, please don't.
No, they definitely do that. My question for you, though, is you found an error. Did you point it out to anybody, or you're like, that's going to be my secret?
It was my secret. No longer.
Until now, yeah.
Well, my question is actually in relation to the glass flower exhibit, and they've been doing them for, you know, years and years and years. So what was the last... I'm trying to figure out how to specifically, without giving this away, but what was the last shipment? What was the last specimen that they created for the museum? Recently, well, it's on display right now, but it's going to be off display in March. It's like one of the rotating parts of the glass flower exhibit.
So the father-son team, what's the last
the
one they created?
The last one, the son created, yes.
I have no idea. Mm.
This is a very specific section of the glass flower exhibit.
Yeah.
It was not on display for about 15, 20 years and just came back in the last few.
Hmm. Wait, was it a diseased apple?
It was a diseased apple.
I told you she was going to get it.
I knew she would get it.
Yeah. Those are amazing. I haven't been to that collection for probably about 10 years. And I haven't seen the apple from that collection, but... In upstate New York, the Corning Museum of Glass also has some plants in their collection, some plant models, and they have diseased apples, and I have seen their diseased apples. And I wonder if it was on loan when I saw it there from Harvard. I'm not sure. But that I've seen a picture of that and it's amazing. And that's a really important thing. Like, a lot of times when we're making plant specimens, either collecting plants or making models of plants, we want it to be like the shiniest, prettiest thing that's sort of very pristine. And that's, you know, that's useful, but it's not useful to everybody. And it's really super useful to see plants that have been eaten by insects, attacked by disease, infected by a virus or a bacterium, so that we can really study disease and the impacts of disease. And at that time, when those models were made, that would have been really crucial too, because you could have something that is just so hyper-realistic without having to have a cutting, a live cutting, you know, of that disease.
Yeah, that's what they said. They used live specimens to, you know,
as
so
a
their
model.
Yeah, so their studio probably was awful.
Didn't
smelling.
Smell good, yeah.
Yeah. How do you, when you're looking at the Botanic Garden, you're figuring out what you're going to have displayed in your specimens, how do you know when it's too diseased? And how do you figure out like what's healthy enough to be there, but also what has scientific value that you guys are going to study?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So for us, because we have a living collection, not a sort of natural history preserved collection, it's really important for us to be as disease, virus, insect-free as we can, pest insect-free as we can in our displays and in our collection. So for example, our orchid collection, we went through a few years ago and tested the entire collection for viruses. Viruses are very common in cultivated orchids. And what we did was we actually treated or composted all of the orchids that were infected by disease. So we saved them if we could. If we couldn't save them, then we had to compost them to destroy them, basically, so that they would no longer be in the collection. And that was really important for us to maintain a healthy collection. We have a lot of wild collected plants that are very important from a conservation perspective, and we wouldn't want them to die because we had a cultivated orchid that came in with a virus. So we continuously virus test all of our orchids as they come in, and we're very proud to have a virus-free orchid collection. So that's something that we try not to really display things that are diseased. When we have a virus, we'll pretty much get rid of those plants. When we have pest infestations, we'll bring in beneficial insects that can control those pest outbreaks.
Right. So would you ever consider, that's obvious that it makes sense that you can't contaminate the whole for the sake of the one. But the concept to me of just listening to this, so I was just looking up the glass flowers the glass exhibit.
You can't tell. You would think it's a real flower.
No, that was I had to do three different searches because every time I brought up the images, I'm like, well, that's not it. And then I actually just read into it and I'm like, oh my God, because I feel like the two of you are perfectly knowledgeable about this because you've done so much research and it's, a lot of what you do. I have no idea what you're talking about. So I wanted to join the conversation. So I looked at it. These things are amazing. And the whole concept of the diseased apple as part of the collection and it being so accurate is amazing. Would you ever consider doing something like that at the Botanic Garden? Just having like an entire section maybe cordoned off?
Quarantined?
Yeah.
So this actually came up a few years ago. We had an exhibit called You Can Grow It. And it was really about people, teaching people how to grow plants. It was really focused a lot on indoor plants. And so we had displays of the kinds of plants that you would grow inside. We talked about how different, light is different from different north, south, east, west facing windows, that kind of thing. And we had a conversation about, we want to show diseases and how to treat them.
Right.
So can we display diseased plants? And our plant healthcare specialist was like, absolutely not. No, under no circumstances can we do that. So what we did is we actually had an artist make a model of a plant, sort of just a thing of a fake plant, where each leaf had a different, either a nutrient deficiency, an insect that was attacking it, had some kind of disease, some sort of pathogen that had impacted it. And then we identified each of those. So it was like one leaf example of each of the really commonly encountered things that we see both at the garden, but also just in cultivated plants that people would see in their homes. And then we had like a little brochure that showed you what it was and what you would do to treat it.
That's awesome. Were they individual leaves, or did you make one worst case scenario plant?
It was like the plant, the saddest plant in history. Yeah, it was one plant.
That's amazing.
Where every leaf was impacted, and there was one leaf that was, because one of the symptoms for this one thing was the leaf falls off, and so there was one leaf on the ground.
Yeah.
That had whatever
by itself.
So yeah. So it's and we still have the model. It's actually one of my favorite things.
Absolutely.
That we've had an artist
make. Yeah, I mean it's if you ever need anything that is completely diseased or doing poorly, if you just want to come over to my house, you can take anything that we have and it would fit into some category somewhere.
Perfect.
Yeah, my wife and I are black thumbs, like perfectly healthy things that come in and are well taken care of still don't do well in our house.
Yeah, my now fiance and I, when we were moving in together, went to IKEA and we decided that we were going to get a cactus at IKEA as it was going to be our love cactus, and this was going to prove that we could live together and survive. And it didn't last very long. I don't know if I overwatered
it. You definitely overwatered it.
I feel like starting off with a love cactus with all of its spines, I don't know if that's the best, maybe.
Well, it's actually a pretty good analogy for their relationship. So yeah, it works out really well.
Perfect.
So. He's all soft and I'm like spiky and
mean.
We're getting married, so
Yeah, it worked out. Yeah, so you probably overwatered it. That's most succulents meet their demise in people's houses because they just get loved to death.
Okay. See, this is good now. We flipped the tables.
Teaspoon of water once a week. Or tablespoon of water once a week.
Yeah, I mean, you can pretty much ignore them from March to, or from October to March.
Yeah.
I just sort of don't water my succulents in that period.
Yeah, we've got, I have one of the greatest achievements of my life in that we were given an orchid when we hosted Thanksgiving and it is still alive today.
Well done.
Thank you. I am unreasonably proud of that accomplishment given my track record.
On the tour of the Botanic Garden, I learned that orchids are sexually deceptive. So how about that?
Some of them are. Yeah.
Some of them are.
Yeah. But I thought that was a great phrase and also a band name. So
yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, but Susan, I want to get into your fact. So we learned that the last one that they sent was the rotting apples for this glass flowers exhibit. Do you have a segue from this to your fact, as we do?
I do. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's sort of an interesting segue, I guess. So can I just ask my question and then I can tell you what the
segue
is?
Sure.
Is that okay? So my question is, can you name five sources of nitrogen for plants? And I'll just jump in to say that nitrogen is a really essential element for plants. It's involved in photosynthesis. It's involved in protein formations and things that sort of allow plants to function and to have structure. So it's really an important nutrient, and it's also the most common nutrient deficiency that would cause all kinds of plant problems for people as they're growing plants. So if your plant's turning yellow and looking really sad, probably my first guess is going to be give it some nitrogen and see if it springs back.
Okay. So as far as nitrogen sources, you mean things that plants consume that provide them with nitrogen?
Things that were sources for plants, sources of nitrogen for plants in nature.
Okay. Lindsay?
Okay. Well, my mother, the biology teacher, would want me to be better at the answer to this question, but I am not a scientist. But I do know basics of photosynthesis, right?
And sure.
So I guess in terms of what specifically you're looking for, like the soil.
Is perfect. That That's one. Yes. Yeah. Good job.
Crushing it. And also, I feel like this is the kind of question you're asking like third and fifth graders, right? And we're like what?
Like 3-year-olds.
Okay. Three. Oh,
no,
gosh.
I'm just kidding.
Okay. So we got soil. I think that.
The water.
I was going to say, is it silly to say water?
Is that through the soil?
Same. Water itself is not going to give a plant nitrogen.
No.
Yeah.
Okay. So
it's got that high quality H2O.
Yeah. Yes. All right. So we're gonna. All right, Lindsay. We can do this.
I believe in us.
All right.
Everyone's here to listen to Susan Pell, this doctor, this amazing expert, and instead they're gonna fumble along with us in a very
We try to figure out an obvious.
As
answer.
You're fumbling through, I'll just sort of add a sort of an addition to the soil answer that you
Please.
Gave. So. I would say soil and other substrates. So sometimes plants are not rooted in the soil. They're rooted in what are sometimes called like soil mats that form in like on tree branches or in the kind of crux between where the branch attaches to the trunk of trees. So you get epiphytic plants, plants that grow attached to other plants that might have a little bit of sort of substrate soil-like material that's up there in the treetops where they're getting nitrogen.
Can I ask a follow-up question in terms of how do plants actually absorb that into themselves? Because I think that could help lead to an answer as to where it's coming from, right? Like, obviously, their roots are in soil, so that's
right.
So how else can plants get nitrogen in terms
of
the how?
Give you that,
yeah,
answer.
That's
no,
what tells
you. No, I'm not saying give me the what. I'm saying the how, right?
Right. Well, that's
they absorb it, and that's all I'm telling you.
I think that's, yeah.
Sometimes that's through the roots, as we've just established. Yeah. So your first
Stop
answer.
Stop hedging, Lindsay. Yeah. Because here's the thing. I know that they don't get it from the air. They can't absorb nitrogen from the air.
That's right. Atmospheric nitrogen is not something that's directly available to the plants.
Right.
But that does kind of lead into one of the other answers. So.
Okay.
Sunlight.
No.
I was thinking of things that you absorb.
Right. It would have to be through pollination? Through?
Nope.
No? Through animal interaction?
Ooh.
So.
Yeah. Feces. Tell me more about that.
Well, yeah, I was definitely going to say.
Feces.
Yeah.
Yes. So let's talk about that for a
Is
second.
Is that really an answer? Feces?
That's really an answer. That's my favorite answer, actually. If you come to the U.S. Botanic Garden and you happen to need our bathroom facilities and you go into a stall or you stand at a urinal, you might see a sign in front of you that tells you a little bit about this and how plants, we like to call them our plant poop stories. So, yes, plants can get nitrogen from poop, from animals, and from insects and also from vertebrates. So a couple of stories there. There's a tropical pitcher plant, the genus Nepenthes, that has evolved to attract a shrew to lick basically like sugar water from its part of the modified leaf that's modified into a pitcher.
Sure.
So it licks off the sugar water, and it stands over the pitcher and it poops and pees into the pitcher, and that's where that plant gets its nitrogen and also phosphorus.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, the fact that how many millions of years did that happen over in order to make that system work?
No idea.
Who even? I mean, obviously, who. Why would that sort of system even evolve? How would that?
You know, best
why is
you,
because it needs the plant needs more nitrogen.
No, I
yeah.
get it.
Utilizing
yeah.
your resources, what's available? There's another pitcher plant that attracts bats to roost inside of it,
okay.
and same thing. The guano
right.
and the pee from the bats goes down into the pitcher, and it also absorbs the nitrogen and phosphorus from the
right.
pee and poop.
All right. Okay. So animal excrement. All right.
Soil.
So okay.
Covering the whole brown spectrum.
Yeah. I'm going through my sixth grade biology class, and I'm going across all of the different kingdoms, right? So we have plants, obviously. We just went through the animal side of things, right? Mm-hmm. And then not
there might be more in the animal side of things,
right? Well, there's I was going into like the bacteria side of things.
Ooh, let's
where
hear that.
There has to be some sort of bacteria that's in the soil that has a special kind of absorption in through the tree. I have no idea how.
All
but
right.
Since we're going through the
let's
kingdoms,
talk about that one.
Yeah.
Yes,
that,
so you're
that
correct.
Should be one,
so bacteria, yeah. Ding ding. Yes, you got it. And
it's I'll say this, Susan, it's very strange that Nick and I are working together. So.
We never do this.
Yeah. Perfect. So yeah, so nitrogen fixating bacteria is a way that plants can get nitrogen that otherwise isn't available to them. So that atmospheric nitrogen that we just talked about, that can be converted into the kind of nitrogen that plants can use. So nitrates and ammonia. And that happens through lots of different ways, but one of them is through a symbiotic relationship that the bacteria have with plants.
Right.
So the bacteria can actually live inside of the plants, and many different plants do this, and there's all kinds of really cool stories related to that. But just to give you like one quick story about that, the reason that we do that crop rotation, or one of the reasons that crop rotation is so important, so rotating, so for example, corn and soybeans.
Right.
One year you grow corn, the next year you grow soybeans. Soybeans have nodules in their roots that have nitrogen-fixing bacteria in them that can do that conversion of atmospheric nitrogen into the nitrogen forms that are available to the plants. So they build up your nitrogen in your soils, and corn is very nitrogen-intensive. It takes a lot of nitrogen out.
Right.
So if you rotate your crops, you're naturally putting nitrogen back into your soil.
Right. Yeah. I actually followed that.
Cool. So a really fun thing, too, is that some of those bacteria that are nitrogen-fixing and that live inside of plants are cyanobacteria, the formerly called blue-green algae. So they actually photosynthesize also, and they fix nitrogen.
That's, yeah. Whoa. That's double duties.
Yeah.
So, okay. So we've got bacteria. Mm-hmm. We've got excrement. We've got the soil itself. There's two more. Wait, no. There's probably more than two more, but you only need two more. dead things.
Dead
Ooh,
things.
Yes.
Dead things. Dead other dead
be more
plants.
Specific.
Other dead plants. Trees.
So
know,
other dead plants. Yeah, that would be part
compost.
Of the soil. Yeah.
Right.
Compost. Yeah. There we go. Nicely done. Yes. So compost. So dead plants and other organic material that gets composted. Yeah. Great source of nitrogen. Great source of organic fertilizer.
Ooh, okay. And now we're down to
that's,
one.
Yeah, that's it. I feel like I've outkicked my coverage here, and I've done the best I can. I've gone through all of the kingdoms. I don't understand the eukaryotes and the other parts, the new stuff. The stuff that didn't exist went back
things,
when they taught
yeah.
it to me.
Every time I think of kingdoms, I'm just thinking of Pokemon class, which is not helpful.
That is
so I'm
not,
just like, a ghost Pokemon. That's not what's happening here.
It's a ground type.
Yeah, actually, in this case, Pokemon might help you a little bit with your last answer.
Interesting.
I think there is,
electricity.
There is a Pokemon that sort of is like this.
Ooh.
And we've already kind of touched on this. So you're really close with dead things and some of your previous answers.
Ooh.
I think Pokemon, I think Pikachu.
Fire. Like burned.
So fire's a great, that's actually a really good answer. But I would put that in with the sort of soil category.
Okay.
Yeah. So fire does kind of prepare soils for regeneration. Mm-hmm. We're already seeing this with the Australian wildfires, actually, where forests are coming back, starting to come back. Seeds are starting to germinate and stuff.
Does that change when a catastrophic event like that happens with the fire? Does that change what actually grows after and
yeah,
it's, when
absolutely.
It's recovering?
Yeah. And you see like the, you know, a lot of those communities are actually fire adapted, and so they're used to having, you know, they've evolved to have fire every, you know, 4 to 10 years or something like that. And those lower intensity fires are, you know, really kind of maintain plant communities, and they're able to kind of spring back from that. When you have catastrophic fires where they're really large fires, very high heat, large, you know, really high flames, that kind of thing, you tend to get more destruction of the habitat, and that can damage the seed bank, which can sort of limit what comes back, but smaller fires, you know, the communities are adapted to those and can spring back from those.
Cool. I found that interesting, but also was stalling to try to also
think of another answer. Yeah.
Think of another Pokemon related thing, but then I got distracted with fire, so I don't know.
It. See, this is why we need Joey and his Pokemon expertise to come to the table.
Okay, so dead things. We talked about the poop. We talked a little bit about these kind of plants and the poop one.
The pitcher plants.
Pitcher plants.
Right.
Oh, insects.
Insects.
Oh,
yay!
There you go.
Yes. So, right. Of course, the carnivorous plants primarily don't exist on poop and peep. They mostly exist on eating insects or digesting insects with either with their own digestive enzymes that they release into the pitchers or through the help of the little micro macro fauna that exist or sort of right. microfauna that exists inside of their pitcher. So all of the different organisms that come into the pitchers and help them digest the insects that fall in there. And some carnivorous plants as well can eat vertebrates. So there are some vertebrates in there as well.
How many types of carnivorous plants are there?
It's a great question.
It's the Venus flytrap, which is just in South Carolina.
It's a north and South Carolina.
Oh, it's north and south. Yep. Okay. And then that was the only one that I knew of.
Yeah, so there's pitcher plants, and there are several different genera that have pitcher leaves modified into pitchers that can okay. trap insects and in some cases vertebrates. There's some that have sticky traps, so it's sort of hairs that are sure. sticky on the leaves. Those are several different plants as well. And there's other active traps. So the Venus flytrap is kind of the most well-known active trap, but there are other active trap carnivorous plants too. So, and there's a couple of others too, but, and I would say there's over 500, some people would say over 700 carnivorous plants.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And a dozen or so families that have carnivorous, carnivory that's evolved in them.
So what's the biggest vertebrae that a plant could eat?
So several years ago when I was living in New York City, there was a very
large...
colleague. Yeah, exactly. Big dude. There was a new species of Nepenthes, which is a tropical pitcher plant genus that was discovered in the Philippines that was very large pitchers. And they found some bones inside of them, and they hypothesized that that it could take, potentially could take, like a large rat.
Wow.
Yeah. Which, of course, the New York City press immediately was
we
like...
We need to get these plants.
Yes, yeah. That's exactly right. That literally contacted us and we're like, is this going to solve our rat problem? I was the bearer of bad news. No, they're tropical no. plants and you're yeah. never going to be able to cultivate them all throughout New York City to eat right. all of our rats.
But
and probably
the
rats in New York City are too big.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to yeah. say, the rats are going to take out those plants in a heartbeat.
Yeah, so probably really small rodents, small frogs right. That get disabled or something and maybe some small rodents, that kind of
right.
thing.
Right.
I was just thinking of Little Shop of Horrors, and I was like,
that's
oh.
exactly what I was thinking.
I was like, oh,
of, yeah.
Audrey 2 must have had a nitrogen deficiency.
That's exactly what it was.
Ay, ay, ay. Oh, man. Okay. So we have the five types. When we ask and we bring this up in trivia, how should we ask our players this question? Like, what do you think is the most important one for folks to take away, beside probably the poop?
I mean the poop.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this is more of a, in addition to dead things, insects, soil, and bacteria, what is the most common method of mm-hmm. nitrogen intake for plants?
Yeah. I think that we got to lock in poop points as our secret phrase, because that's what they'll get when they know that answer.
Absolutely.
They'll say poop. They get the points. I think poop points will be our secret phrase.
Perfect.
So, Susan, what's that secret phrase?
Poop points.
Poop points.
Poop points. That's going to be
points
your secret phrase. Yes. Points for poop. So, Susan, as we wrap up, and in your entirety of your career, which has spanned a lot of different gardens, a lot of great places, what is the thing that made you go, whoa, wow, the most that you learned? This is a very tough question, and that's why I'm ending with it.
Yeah.
I mean, every day at the U.S. Botanic Garden, as I walk around, I do that. So, the most recent thing, last week, I was rushing off to a meeting, running through the conservatory, or walking quickly, safely, through the conservatory, and I went into the orchid room.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like late and whatever, and I looked up in the orchid room, and our employees had put together such an amazing display of orchids. It was like the best one I've seen, and I just stopped right in my tracks and appreciated it and recognized that they're now grouping in that room plants based on where they're from geographically and the kind of habitats that they live in. And that really comes across in a really beautiful way. So every visitor's not going to take that in. They're not going to be like, oh, that's, you know, those are all Asian orchids. But they just go together nicely. And so that's the thing that stopped me in my tracks recently. But, you know, plants are amazing. And every day at the garden, I'm blown away. So today I gave a tour. And I noticed that one of our bamboo shoots is really going crazy right now, and it's just huge, and it's only probably 6 weeks old, and it's 15 feet tall already.
Right.
Those things just blow me away, how fast things can grow, how just beautiful plants are, how diverse they are.
Yeah.
What was the best question you ever gotten on a tour? Did anyone ever stump you or ever make you have to be like, wait, I have to go look that up immediately?
Oh, gosh, I get a lot of great questions. And certainly I get stumped. Yeah, I mean, people, there's, you know, the plant world is so huge and so diverse that things come up that I definitely don't know, you know, every day. But, you know, I don't, yeah, people, I can't think of like what the best question is. I think, you know, I always love when somebody brings a fact to me, like they just read an article or they got excited about something or they're growing a plant that they're excited about. They pull their phone out and show me their pictures, ask me questions that way. I on my tour today, I was talking about banyan trees, which is a kind of fig tree that just makes these huge, almost like walk-in chambers with their roots. They're roots that grow down from their branches to root into the soil. And I told the story and I just saw like half the people lit up. And after the tour, people waited to talk to me to like show me their picture. They had a panoramic picture of a banyan tree that they saw at a hotel in Hawaii. And they were like, you've got to see this. And they were just, you could just see like how excited they were about the banyan, that it just existed and that they had seen it and that they had this great picture of it and that I had mentioned it. I mean, you know, just, I love that excitement that people have and the things you never know, like what the connection is you're going to make to a visitor. You know, I try to tell people stories and all different, you know, cultural stories and food stories and just ecological stories, conservation stories, weird, funny poop stories, all kinds of things. And you never know like what's going to be that one thing that really stays with that visitor and just gets them excited about plants and wanting to come back to the garden to see more and more plants and to learn more about plants.
Yeah. And so now everybody needs that. Well, everybody that's in DC or just fly in, make the trip. Thursday, February 27th is our first one. We're also going to be doing these in March, April, and May. Yep. So we have a full series, and this is accessible to the Susans of the world. Those are our 10-point questions.
Right.
And
the Knicks of the world.
And the Knicks of the world. And definitely the Lindsays, because I'm in that one-point range. I got it. But yeah, definitely get your tickets. Like we said, food, drink. It's going to be so much fun. And you get to explore the garden without a lot of the middle school tourists, which they're all nice and everybody should see the garden, but you know, it's a lot more fun when you have it to yourself.
it's always fun to go in someplace where you're not supposed to be after hours and just be there. It's just really cool.
The garden's really magical at night. The light is totally different. There's not as many people there, right? So you really get to explore, see the tropics in a whole different light.
Yeah, well, we'll have that link in the link dump or just head to districttrivia.com. Susan, thank you so much for teaching us a million things. My mind is like absolutely blown, and I'm excited to go back to the garden because your tour was incredible, but I feel like there's still so much left to learn. And I will see everybody on the 27th.
Yeah, I'm definitely buying my ticket to go play now.
Yeah. You're charged double. this has been the We Don't Know Either podcast. I'm Lindsay.
I'm Nick.
I'm Susan.
And we don't know either.
Bye.